My name is Steve Lamb, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Steve.
It's good to be here. It's good to be sober. I don't know about that lead-in, Sandy. That's, you know, when he asked me about this, I naturally said yes because I've been conditioned in Alcoholics Anonymous to say yes even when I think, not really, not so much. I really don't want to. But I say yes because that's what I've been taught to do. But I got to tell you, we were out by the fire, and George was talking about Scott Redmond, and Sandy started talking about Scott Redmond, and Scott Redmond is why I'm here. He had asked me in the summer of 2006 to come to this retreat, but I couldn't go because I was in the middle of trial. So I missed it, and when he was sick, one of the things that he said was, you got to go. So I'm here, and I'm really glad that I'm here. And as one of the many things that Scott gave me before he left this world, I'm very grateful for that. Since we've been talking about spirituality the whole weekend, I thought maybe I'd talk about it too. But to give you a little bit of background, I got to AA in 1996. So I've got a little over 12 years sober. I really don't frankly have that much experience, but it's very dear and near to me, my experience. And when I got here, it took me a little while to get a sponsor. I wasn't one of those people that took to the program immediately. I went about 100 days and I didn't get a sponsor. I had read the book a couple times, and it seemed pretty interesting. And I was going to meetings every day, and I wasn't drinking. And I thought that that was good enough, and I thought, I'm in AA. I'm in AA. I didn't realize that I was attending Alcoholics Anonymous, that I wasn't in AA. You know, that I was doing a lot of activity, but I wasn't taking the action that we talk about in the big book, because that didn't dawn on me. And in my background, I've, you know, been to college, I've been to law school, I got a lot of education, but I couldn't seem to grasp that fundamental concept. In fact, I remember in my first few days in AA, there was a debate in the morning meeting about God and the book, and was there too much God in the book or higher power, and there was a discussion about that, and I remember thinking, I don't even remember that. I must have missed that. I don't remember the discussion about God. I remember there was this guy named Bill, and he seemed to be a stock speculator. It had to do with Hampshire Grenadiers, and he drank, and some guy named Debbie, and, you know, and I drink, you know, and I don't drink now, and that's about as far as I got. And I remember steps, and they, I mean, clearly you guys needed to do them, but I didn't, you know, I didn't want to overreact here. You know, I wanted to be sober, I thought, but I didn't want to really do anything about it. So, again, I went about 100 days, and I went on a business trip, and I went back to Minneapolis, St. Paul, and then I went to Pittsburgh, and I was doing some depositions, and I had a hotel room, and I was flying back, and I had an honor bar, which is a joke for an alcoholic, because, you know, you don't have a lot of honor when you're an alcoholic. And I went to the honor bar, and I opened it. It's a little fridge, and inside it was everything I ever wanted, everything I ever needed, and it was all in there. And I knew I wanted it. I mean, I wanted to drink. I'd gone about 100 days, longest I'd ever gone, it seemed to me, without drinking, and I wanted it, and I needed it. And I didn't do what you guys had told me to do. I didn't go to another city and call the central office or the inner group or hook up. I didn't have a sponsor, so I didn't call him. I didn't have friends in AA on a phone list that I could contact while I was out of town. So I was, in my mind, all alone. One of the things we talked about over the last couple days. I had this feeling of conscious separation. I now believe that there is no separation. But at that particular moment in 1996, I felt like I was all alone. There was no unity whatsoever. And I remember I opened the little mini bar, the honor bar, and I opened it and I shut it, and I opened it and I shut it, and I finally I opened it and I drank everything in the mini bar except the alcohol. I mean, I drank everything. I was just manic. I drank the tonic water, which just sucks without gin. I mean, there's no point to it. But, you know, when you're on this mission and you're on a roll, you just do it. And so I drank it and I shut it. And then I opened it and I organized it, domestics, imports, because I'm going to drink it, you know. And I'm watching TV and I'm going back and forth from religious television to porn. You know, I'm going back and forth, religious TV, porn. And that's not so bad, except I'm getting confused. So finally my flight comes, and I don't drink, and I go out to the airport, and I get on the plane, I fly back to Los Angeles, and I got a plan, you know, and my plan is this. I get up in the morning, and I take out a kit bag that I had when I was in the Army, and I pull it out, and I take all the demo out, and I take all the weapons out, which I've since gotten rid of, and I took out a bunch of passports that I'd acquired and used for God and Country when I was in Special Forces that I'd neglected to turn back in because, like the demo and the weapons, I thought, you know, they might come in handy someday. So I take all this stuff out, and I take these 13 passports with my photograph and different names on them. Should have turned back in, and I lay them all out, and I take out my tourist passport. And all 13 passports that I should have turned back in that are illegal, they're still current. They haven't expired, but my tourist passport's expired. You know? Well, I wasn't laughing. I was just devastated. I can't do my plan, because my plan is I'm going to take my tourist passport and I'm going to fly to British Columbia, and then I'm going to take these other passports and I'm going to start working my way east. And I'm going to go to London, and then I'm going to go over to Germany, and I'm going to work my way back. And as I work my way back, Steve Lamb will cease to exist. It's just a bad dream. When I get to British Columbia, I'm going to head down to Costa Rica. I've got some friends from my Army days that are doing some interesting marketing and distribution, and I'm going to join them. And, you know, I got to tell you, I'm not proud of this. I got a wife. I got a kid. I do not think about them for a minute. Not for a second. Not for a millisecond. You know, I'm selfish. I'm self-centered. I'm self-seeking. But again, I don't have a sponsor. I haven't done the work yet. I think I'm crazy. And I've since found out, this is pre-9/11, I could have flown up there on my driver's license. But what, I don't know about you guys, but I was emotionally, socially, and kind of mentally, mechanically retarded when I got here. People would talk to me, and I would hear every third or fourth word. Like I said, I would read the book. I had no reading comprehension. I just didn't understand. I felt like I was wrapped in cotton and bouncing off walls all the time. You know, no sense of purpose. And what I'd remembered that morning was one of these stupid, pathetic AA phrases, and it was this. It was, you know, if your ass has fallen off, put it in a bag and take it to a meeting. Now, I don't know if they say that out here, and I don't even know what the hell that means, and I don't think there's a bag big enough for my ass, but it has something to do with going to a meeting. So I go to a meeting that morning, and there was a guy there. I didn't much care for him, and he was talking about sponsorship, and he was ranting and raving about sponsorship and going on and on and on, and so I went up to him, and he said during his talk, he said, you know, if you have questions about sponsorship, you need a sponsor, come talk to me, and, you know, and I'll help you get a sponsor. So I went up to him afterwards, and I said, you know, Jim, I heard you talking about sponsorship, and I thought it's been about 100 days. I thought it was about time for me. And, you know, let's talk about this process. And he looked at me, and he said, you know, you are pathetic. And he grabbed me by the shoulder, and he took me outside. And he went up to a guy that I'd never met before, and he said, Michael, Steve, Michael, sponsor, sponsee, go with God. And I'm thinking, oh, I don't think so. I mean, this is, you know, there's got to be some selection process. I've got some real problems here, and I don't know this guy. He's younger than me. I've never heard him share. I don't know that he can meet my strict qualifications for sponsor, whatever the hell those are. And I was really confused. And Michael starts reaching in his pocket, and he grabs a card, and he says, he's writing on it. He's writing his address and his phone number. He says, you got a book? And I said, yeah, I got a book. He said, good. You're going to need it. Be at my house Monday, 6:30. And I'm thinking, there's no way. But what I said was, okay. You know, and for me, that was my first step in Alcoholics Anonymous. We later did some work, some writing on that first step, but that was the moment in time where I not only accepted that I was powerless over alcohol, because I'd admitted that for a long time, but I didn't accept the fact that my life was unmanageable. I thought if I just tweak it a little bit or do this or do that, I can figure it out, I can sort it out. But now I'm ready to turn my will and my life over to God. Through this intermediary, I'm going to call a sponsor because he's going to review stuff and explain stuff to me. He's going to be my spiritual guide. And I met with him every Monday night at 6:30, and we worked through the steps out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was augmented by the 12 and 12, particularly when we got to chapter 6 and 7, because there's not a lot about that, or step 6 and 7 in the book. And what I want to talk about briefly tonight is what happened when we got to the 11th step. Because it seemed to me that when we went through all the steps, I was getting specific instruction and specific direction. For example, on the fourth step, he had a particular way to do it, and he wanted columns, and he didn't really care if I wrote this long missive. He really wanted bullet points, subject, verb, object. That's all he cared about, because we were looking at patterns for character defects. You know, same thing with the fear inventory, same thing with the sex inventory. When we got to the eighth step, he not only wanted to see my list from the fourth step, but he wanted to have me write out my list of proposed amends so that I could review them with him before I did them. And I did that, and I made a lot of mistakes. I had to go back a couple times. But when we got to the 11th step, I felt like he was just saying, well, we read it in the book, and go with God. And I kept saying, well, Michael, I mean, what do you actually do? Pray and meditate. I mean, actually, what do you do? What prayer? What meditation? It doesn't tell me what method of meditation. And I remember, and this is one of the greatest things that Michael ever gave to me, he said, you know, I can tell you what, because I asked him, what do you do? And he said, I can tell you what I do, but it's going to be largely irrelevant for you because this is my experience. This is Alcoholics Anonymous, and you're here to have your experience, not my experience, your experience. So he said, just go try a bunch of things. And my recommendation to you is to try them for at least 3 or 4 weeks because, you know, they may not take. So I did all kinds of stuff. I mean, and it seemed like it was crazy stuff to me. I mean, I remember started on the 11th step before my first birthday. And he had me get an egg timer. And he said, and I want you to set it at least initially for 2 or 3 minutes. And what I want you to do is I want you to read something spiritual. It can be from the big book, the 12 and 12 Daily Reflections. He was not a fan of sticking to conference-approved literature. One of the things that he gave me was Around the Year with Emmett Fox, which I give to all the guys that I sponsor. And he also was a big fan of the 24-Hour Day book. And he also said you might want to read the background of that, because I'm a big history buff, called God Calling, by two listeners, because that's basically what started then. But he said, you can read the Bible, you can read the Quran, you can read whatever you want, but spend, you know, 5 to 15 minutes and read something and then reflect on it and say a couple prayers and then just turn the timer on and get quiet. See what happens. And the first, I'll tell you what happened. I waited for the timer to go off. You know, I turned it on and went off and I went, we're done with that and I'm out of there, you know. And I seemed to be getting a little calmer, but I couldn't understand it. I was in a lot of difficulty with it. And he had suggested different meditation books, and I had, you know, he's a big fan of Joel Goldsmith, so I was reading a lot of Goldsmith, and one of the things that I was doing was I was trying different forms of meditation. I was getting these tapes, and I remember I did this one with a candle, and I stared at the candle, I meditated, and I had to give that up because I almost burned the house down. And there was one that had like the crashing surf and the running water, and that didn't work for me because I just had to pee. And, you know, so I tried all these things. And if those things work for you, I don't mean to be disparaging, but they did not work for me. And I was really, I think, coming up on my second birthday. And I'm doing this every morning, and nothing's happening. Nothing's happening. And one of the things that I was focusing on through my readings is I had read a new pair of glasses by then. And there's a phrase that Chuck Chamberlain refers to in A New Pair of Glasses, which is from the Bible. It's Acts 17, verse 28. And it's, for in him we live and move and have our being. And he would say that a couple times. It's a couple times in the book. Just kind of, and it would pop out at me. And Goldsmith used that phrase a lot. And I used to ponder about that. And one of the things that I would reflect on and meditate is, you know, for in him we live and move and have our being. That'd be nice. I'd like to live and move and have my being in him. That'd be good. What does that mean? How do I get there? And then another thing that was very popular in Goldsmith, and it's something that I'd read, was from the Bible also. It was from Psalm 46, verse 10. And it is, be still and know that I am God. And this one particular morning, this is how I'm doing my meditation. I'm sitting there. I'd done my reading. I'd said a couple prayers, and I'm sitting there, and I'm, be still and know that I'm God. Okay, turn the timer. Be still, be still, be still. I don't feel very still. Know that I'm, well, I know I'm not God. I've read Ernest Kurtz's book. It's, I'm not God. I know I'm not God. I can't be God. But sponsor tells me I'm not God. I'm not God. But it says, I am God. I am. I remember there's something about Moses where I am that I am. I don't know what the hell that means. Be still and know that I'm God. I'm not very still. This is not working. And I'm, you know, having this conversation with myself. And what I heard plain as day, very loud, very clear, was shut up. Now, this scared the hell out of me. It's maybe 5 o'clock in the morning. I jump bolt upright. I run down the hall. I'm thinking my wife is screwing with me, you know, or the garbage man is outside. Nobody's out there. It's dead calm, dead quiet. I can't go back and meditate. I can't. I go talk to Michael. I say, Michael, what does it mean? You know, I mean, am I going crazy? Am I having a psychotic experience? And he said, you know what? Well, I don't know. Maybe God talked to you. And I said, well, what does it mean? He said, maybe it means to shut up. You know, be still, be quiet, and know that I am God. So I went back and I meditated and I tried. And finally, I got to be still. And I got to the point where I was so desperate, you know, which to me is the gateway of grace, that I just got still. I had no thoughts. And I remember I was sitting there one morning and something happened. And I'd like to be able to describe it to you and tell you what it was. I know it was beautiful. I know it was joyous. I know it was pleasant. And I know it was familiar. And the sense of separation was completely gone. And I can't do any better job at describing it than that. And I was very excited, and I wanted to do it again. And the next morning, I couldn't get it. I couldn't find it. It was lost. You know, and did I really have it? And I remember thinking, well, this kind of sucks. I mean, I didn't expect a burning bush or anything like that. I didn't think, you know, God was going to say, this is my son in whom I'm well pleased. But, you know, shut up. That's my moment. And I was talking to Michael, and I said, you know, I don't know. I mean, is this supposed to be my moment of clarity? And Michael said, moment of clarity? Where'd you hear that crap? I said, well, I hear it in the meetings all the time. He said, well, is that in the book? I said, well, I don't know. I check. No, it doesn't seem to be in the book. Is it in the 12 and 12? No. He said, well, that may be one of those urban AA legends that you hear about, that people think about. He said, why don't you see how much desperate and desperation is in the book? And I looked. It's in there like 8-10 times. A lot of people are desperate. A lot of desperation. There's a lot of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. There's never any clarity. And that's what it was for me. So people talk about this moment of clarity. I didn't have a moment of clarity. I had a moment of desperation where I was so beat down, I could get still enough to let something happen. You know, the whole concept of God but not God. And, you know, I felt this thing and I wanted this thing. And I'm working with guys and I'm meditating. I'm trying to find this thing and I can't find it again. And I had a little less than 4 years of sobriety, and I went to the international convention in Minneapolis. And my whole family went. We went to the last one in Toronto, and they love it. And I remember I got on the bus. I was outside of Minneapolis, and I drove in and went to a couple meetings. And then I was sitting outside. They have a whole area. They had a whole area there with kind of the whole AA paraphernalia thing and a bunch of booths, and then an area with some trees. And I was sitting there just kind of looking at some of the stuff that I'd bought. And this gentleman walks up, and he was wearing a monk's cassock. And he walks up to me, and he sits down on the grass next to me. And he says, are you here for the convention? And I said, yeah, my name's Steve Lamb. I'm from Redondo Beach. He said, how about you? Are you here for the convention? He said, yeah, I am. I said, are you an AA? He said, no, I'm not an AA. I just came up for the convention. And I said, well, where are you from? He said, well, I'm from this little place. You've probably never heard of it. It's in Kentucky. It's called Gethsemane. And it just kind of freaked me out because I'd been reading a lot of Thomas Merton, and Thomas Merton was from Gethsemane. And one of the things that struck me about Merton was he said something to the effect, and I'm going to paraphrase, you know, God, I don't know what your will for me is, but I believe that by trying to do your will, that somehow pleases you. And that's enough. That's a humanity. I'm just going to try. And so I'm talking to this guy, and you know, I said, well, why are you here? And he said, well, you know, I travel around. I like to go to a lot of different things that are spiritually based. I've been to India. You know, I've been to Tibet. And my particular order allows me to go out every year or so and do this. And he wasn't that old a guy. He was in his 40s or so. And I said, well, that's really cool. And he asked me some questions, and I don't remember saying a lot, but it felt like a really strange experience. You know, it just felt like he and I were sitting there and no one else was there. And then he was talking to me, and I made this comment to me. I said, so you're a seeker. And I thought that was kind of a nondescript, non-confrontational comment. And he smiled at me, and he kind of said, well, I don't really think of myself that way. I think of myself more as an uncoverer, a discoverer, maybe a realizer. And I'm thinking, well, all right, that's a little bit smarmy for me. I don't, but this guy's kind of nice, and I don't really understand. He could tell that I was a little confused. And what he said to me was was interesting to me later. He said, the essence of a rose and the essence of the seed of the rose are the same. That you don't need to look for God out there. You just need to turn within because it's all the same. It's the same chemical composition. It's the same chemical and spiritual DNA. And man's inability to realize the similarity and likeness between the seed and the rose does not make it any less true. And I'm looking at him, and I'm still really not getting it. And he says, you know, the fact that man does not see God within does not mean that God does not exist within. It just means that God hasn't realized it, just like the rose and the seed. And there's no difference. And we all share the same spiritual DNA. And there is a unity there that can be found within. And I'm thinking, this is really weird. I don't even know who this guy is, and he's talking to me. And I said, well, you know, that's nice. And he said, well, have a good day. And he got up and left, and he walked away, and I never saw the guy again. And I really pondered about that a long time, because it just seemed like this odd coincidence that I should meet this monk at this particular time, and that he would say something to me that would really make me stop and think about what I was trying to do. Because I'd always thought about, you know, I gotta do something. I gotta find the way to meditate, or I gotta read the right book, or I gotta do this. And one of the things that's interesting, we have in the back there, Joel Goldsmith's The Thunder of Silence. Fantastic book. He probably wrote 30 books. They're very, very similar. I read them all. I started thinking, these all sound the same. And then I read one of his books where he says, you know, there'll come a time when you'll read all these books and it's all the same crap. And I thought, you know, you're right. It is. And there'll come a time when you just put it aside and let God into your life. But how do you do that? How do you practically do that? I mean, what do you physically do? And I was trying, because I would occasionally get still in the morning, and I'd feel it in the morning, or I'd feel it at night. But during the day, it felt like, you know, I'm kind of on my own. You know, I'd check in at night, I'd check in the morning, and what happens all day long? And then I'd read again A New Pair of Glasses by Chuck Chamberlain. One of the practices that Chuck had was, when he was living down in Laguna Beach, he'd moved, and he would drive all the way into downtown L.A., and he would talk to God on the way. And I thought, I'll try it. I'll try it. You know, why not? And it's easier now because we've got cell phones, so they think that you're just talking on the cell phone. I mean, back then they probably thought you're crazy. Although I tell you, the other day I actually got pulled over by a cop because I took a right when I shouldn't have taken a right. And he said, who are you talking to? Because in California now, you've got to be on Bluetooth. And I said, nobody. And he said, well, I saw you talking. Who are you talking to? And I thought, oh, because I'd forgotten. And I'm thinking, I can't tell this. I was talking to God. Yeah, I don't think that's going to work out well. So I just said, well, I was just talking to myself. But I got into the practice where I would have this conversation with God. You know, and I would get up in the morning, I would do the same daily routine, and then I basically would say, okay, I'm at it. This is the plan. I'm going to try not to do any damage, and I'm going to try to do your will. And by the way, you know, if you're up there and you're thinking about me and something comes to you as I screw up, you know, before I do it, it'd be nice if you give me a little hint. I would appreciate that. And that's pretty much what I would do, and that's what I've been doing for a number of years. And by doing that and taking moments during the day to reflect, I think that I can be more aware. Because my belief is that, you know, Chuck drew the, in his book, he drew the circle. You know, life, God, good, and then him or me or you outside the circle. And I always thought I was outside the circle. The reality is I'm not outside the circle. I'm inside the circle. And the better reality of that is there really isn't an end to the circle. Because that would be to define and limit God. There is no end. I'm in the middle. I'm the same as you. I'm with you. I share the same spiritual DNA as you. What I do to you and with you has an impact on you. And what you do to and with each other has an impact on me. And if I keep that in my mind and I keep that in my heart, I will tend to be less destructive as the day goes on. Because to me, it's too overwhelming to just sit there and think of God all the time. That which I don't understand. But I can think of you. Because it's my belief that I'm supposed to be here to be with you. And the reason why I know that is because all this time when I'm searching and trying to get that moment back, when I'm meditating, and it comes back fleetingly, and sometimes it happens and sometimes it doesn't, every single time I've done a fifth step with another man, where I've sat down at 2:00 in the morning, and he's reading to me his deepest, darkest secrets. That space that doesn't exist between me and God, but I feel is there, absolutely doesn't feel like it's there at all. And there's absolute unity. And I'm absolutely confident to my core that there is a God. And that it's not me, and then I am doing his will at that moment. There's no question. And so is that man, because we know that we're not drinking right now, even though that's our nature. That's what we're supposed to do. And we're going to get up and we're going to go out the next day and grab a newcomer and take him to a meeting and do it all again. And for me, you know, that is really what it's all about. One of the things that's in the reading, I think it's in the reading back there, there's some books by Meister Eckhart, and one of the things that really touched me in those readings was he said a couple things. First of all, he said, if the only prayer that you were ever to say in your entire life was thank you, that would suffice. Just thank you. Very simple. And he also said something that is, in my mind, somewhat similar to what's been discussed today. He said, the more you seek God, the less you find God. The less you seek God, the more you find God. God doesn't ask anything of you. God doesn't ask anything of you except that you let go and let God be God in you. And that is, in my view, living and moving and having our being in him who presides over us all. And I can't get that alone. You know, I can only get that with my contact with you. So I'm really glad to be here tonight. Thanks.
That was great. Our second guest is from nearby Tavares, Florida, and I'm sure everyone's heard of that. I've known him for quite a few years, but we don't see each other as often. I'd go up to visit George Dunn, who comes here on a regular basis, and we'd go play a little golf. And I find him just a delightful man, and let's have a nice welcome for Bud Stalter. Bud, come on up. You can put that wherever.
I bet you just went out.
Okay.
Okay for what? A warning first. This is a lozenge. And I got a reason for telling you that. I got this here. You hear my froggy voice? Well, I've had cancer of the vocal cords, and they did 5 surgeries, and every time they took a little more of my voice. Left me with one, though, so I'm grateful. So when I talk, I have to use these throat lozenges and some lubrication to keep me going. And that's why I'm telling you about this, because I get excited. Sometimes I forget I got them in there, and I spit them out, and they come out, come out about 45 miles an hour. I have broken people's eyeglasses with those things. I am really thrilled to be here. I have mixed emotions about being up here. I used to make a living doing seminars for a corporation. I spoke to 100,000 people a year for 10 years straight, and until I drank myself out of that job. And then after I got sober, I did alcohol and drugs in the workplace, seminars on when and how to intervene, trying to get corporations and business owners and government agencies to help the alcoholic rather than fire them. And I spoke to about 3/4 of the Fortune 500, and in between surgeries and so on, I finally lost that privilege. I understood something, that everything I've got, everything I do that's good came from God. It's a gift. And he gave me the gift to speak, and then he said, that's enough, and took it away. And then he taught me how to learn how to listen and how to be silent. And when I think about where I ended up, I go back and take a look at how he got me here, I mean, it's just a well-laid plan. I'm a counselor. I have been for 25 years, and I work with clients with alcohol and drug problems and their families. And I do a lot of listening. I like to listen. I learned how to listen to what people are trying to say. I've learned to listen how what people are saying but can't find the words to say. And I have learned that I have said things to people that I've never read and I've never heard, and I know and I believe those are inspirations from God. He says, hey, this person needs to hear this. I'll put this in your head. You say it, he'll listen. I just believe that. I don't think that's ego. I got an ego. I didn't know why I came here. I found out in the first few minutes. I have been living in an egotistical trance, and I am disconnected spiritually. I still pray the way that Sandy talked about. I pray the words, but there is no connection, and I know it, and I didn't know what was happening. How I got here was from George Dunn. I didn't know he came here, and he didn't tell me after he got back. I just noticed something happened to George. He's talking about God is everything or he is nothing. I said, where did George get that from? George doesn't talk that way. And I watched and I listened to him, and he was different. And, you know, I went up to George. I said, you're different. He says, I am how? And I told him what I had watched and observed. It reminded me that a lot of the things that happened to me that I didn't know happened either, somebody had to tell me. You're different. I am really how. So I told him. And he told me that he came down here. I said, oh, do you think that's something I ought to do? And he says, I think everybody ought to do it. And that was the end of that. About 3 months later, I was in another spiritual crisis, and I saw George at the meeting. I said, George, where is this place? He gave me the email. I checked it. And I signed up to come to this one. I got so excited, I came last week. I did. I am not well yet. I am a work in progress. For 25 years, I hit my 25th anniversary this year. The miracle of that was the first year. I never imagined that I would ever be sober for a whole year. I have no idea how I got there. I remember how I came in. I came in angry, full of resentments, didn't want to be there. Came because nothing else had worked. I knew this worked for some people, so I was going to go find out if it worked for me. And I brought the body, and that was it. The first meeting I attended, I had been sober for about 3 months. Well, maybe I should preface that with when I was in 1980, I had an alcohol-induced withdrawal heart attack, which means I couldn't get to any alcohol because it was a dry county. And so I coughed so hard all night long in withdrawal, I busted a valve. So I did what any good alcoholic would do. The next morning, I was at the convenience store at 6 a.m., bought two 16-ounce, 12-packs of Budweiser. I don't know what I thought I was going to do with that. And I drank one, and then I drank two, and I drank three. Then I drank one when I was taking a shower, drank one when I was shaving, drank one when I got dressed, and put one in the car and drank one on the way to the hospital, locked up the car, walked in the emergency room and said, can I help you? And I said, yeah, I'm having a heart attack. They could smell the alcohol. You probably think you're having one, but you probably really got a gastritis problem. But just to make you feel better, we'll check you out. The doctor was a real smart ass. And they checked it out. And then I heard a page, Dr. Robinson, please come to the emergency room. So this big tall guy came in, and he was talking to this other emergency room doctor, and they came in together, and he says, Mr. Stalder, the emergency room doctor said, Mr. Stalder, I'm sorry for being so flippant. You really did have a heart attack, and since I am so inappropriate, I thought Dr. Robbins should come down and take care of you. Dr. Robinson turned out to be instrumental in my recovery, and he's not even an alcoholic. But his wife died in bed next to him when he was 35 years of alcoholism and pill overdose. He didn't even know she was alcoholic. He had a son that was a drug addict and another daughter that was a drug addict. So he knew a lot about it. I thought he felt sorry for me, you know, ego. I thought he felt sorry for me, and he didn't really want to be my friend. Come home and have dinner with us. It took me about 2 months to realize that he was the one that needed help. He was looking to me for help. I thought he'd... So they went to Colorado skiing and asked me to house sit for them. I did. The second day after they left, I got drunk. I drank up everything he had. I went to the store and got a big supply of beer and just stayed plastered for about 10 days. And then I knew that he was coming back, so I did the best I could to clean up the beer cans and the bottles and called a cab and checked myself into detox. I walked in. They did a BL on me, blood alcohol level. I was 4-4 and walking. That was the last drink I ever took was then, because that day Dr. Robinson came in and he said, "But I am really angry with what you did. But you're my friend, and I want you to come over to the house for dinner tonight." And then I looked up at him, and he had a tear running down his face. And I hadn't remembered anybody crying about me in years and years and years, and it struck me someplace spiritually inside, and I said, "Okay." We had dinner, and he said, "Anything you want to do?" And I said, "Yeah, I think I want to go to an AA meeting." So I went down there. I remember looking inside this building, and it was dark outside, so I could look in and see everybody in there. And this was the thought that went through my head. If I go in there, everybody's going to know I'm an alcoholic. Well, everybody in there was an alcoholic, but that's the way I thought. It was an interesting meeting. There were some people in there then, and a priest, and the topic, I never did figure out there was a topic, that they were talking about why blacks don't get sober. I'm not kidding you, that was just talking about their morals and all of this kind of stuff. And then they attacked some young guy that had relapse. I guess he's in and outer, and he got so mad he picked up the damn chair and threw it across the room right into the wall, scared the devil out of me. That was my first meeting. So I got so much out of that, I came back. I hung around AA, and I wasn't really in it, but I came. Somebody said 90 meetings in 90 days. I said, "Okay." And so I did 126 meetings in the first 90 days, no commitment. Didn't tell anybody I wasn't committed, but I wasn't. I didn't know if I was done yet. So I said, "Well, my life is better than it was. I guess I'll give it another 90 days. So I went to 106 meetings in the second 90 days and still wasn't committed. I didn't go to 100 and any meetings. I didn't even keep track of them in the third 90 days. But when the 90 days was up and I went up to get my chip on the way back down from up front and setting down, I realized that somewhere in those 3 months, I had made the decision to make this my way of living, and I wasn't even in on the decision, not consciously in on the decision. So when people say you'll never get sober if you're angry, well, I said, "Well, maybe not, you know. And you got to make a decision." I said, "I didn't." God was making the decision for me. He just kept bringing me back and bringing me back and bringing me back. Well, once I had made the decision, I got into it. And I got into it good. I got a sponsor, fired him in 2 weeks. I had to get somebody that was an executive like I used to be. So I got a marketing executive. Good Lord, no wonder I was in trouble. You know, he was just like me. He couldn't help me, so I got a doctor. That was prestigious, wasn't it? I got rid of him too, because he didn't do anything. And then I went to a meeting, and there was this loud Irishman there named John McGuire. I can use his name because he died 2 years ago. And somebody came down, from New York City and evidently thought we didn't have a big book and started talking at everybody at this noon meeting like we didn't know anything. John was there and had enough, and he said, "Will you shut the hell up?" He says, "We got one right here. You see it? Same one you got in New York City. We've had it down here for years." Just gave that guy holy hell. And I says, "That's it. That's my sponsor." I don't know why, but that was going to be my sponsor. John had a prestigious job. He put up street signs for the city of Tavares, stop signs, yield signs, and stuff like that. Turned out to be the best match in heaven could make. He was my sponsor for 23 years until he died, and I was with him when he died. I could tell him anything. He knew me well enough that he didn't press when he knew I would resist. But he would suggest and guide and ask me how I was doing and wondered if I ought to try this to see if I could find some relief. And I got to tell you, I got to check my cards here, because when I got 1 year of sobriety, they asked me to be a speaker. I knew they would. I was just waiting for my chance, and John says, "Hell no, you ain't talking to anybody." I said, "Why not?" He says, "Your ego can't tell the truth because your ego doesn't know the truth." I believed him. He was right about most everything else. So I said, "Okay." And I didn't. And he told me he would let me know when it was time to tell my story. I don't do it very often because I still hear that message, bud, that John gave me. I have to watch my ego. My ego doesn't know the truth a lot of the times. You know, I want to get up here and be like everybody else. I want to be funny. I did it last night, or actually I did it today. During the quiet time, I had a meeting with my sponsor and asked him, as I always have in the past, if it's okay for me to speak. And I can put John in my mind's eye anytime I wanted to. He just kind of laughed at me, put his arm around me, and gave me a hug. And he turned around and walked away, never said a word. And I said, "What the hell does that mean?" And he just kept going. I would say that a lot in AA. What does that mean? For example, when I was trying to connect with a higher power, somebody said, "Has anybody got a topic?" And I said, "I do. I am struggling with connecting to my higher power." And it was a big meeting. It went away all the way around the room. Got to over to a guy I didn't know. Never saw him before. Never saw him again. Burly guy with a James Dean jacket on, big burly white hair. I got around to him and he says, "You, what's your name?" "Me?" He says, "You." I says, "Bud." He says, "Bud, when you hear the thunder, the lightning has already struck." What the hell does that mean? It came to me. Like a lot of things do. Like looking at those things, all of a sudden they're there. When you start talking about a higher power, you already got one, you just don't know it. What a wonderful message to receive. I had one, I didn't even know it. I don't know if you've ever gone looking for something and didn't know what you're looking for. That's what I did. That's what I came here for. I didn't know why I was here. Found out in a hurry why I'm here. I'm blocked. Everything that I know, everything that I've learned, and Sandy, you talked about that earlier, you get it all up there and it blocks it, and I'm blocked. I got to clear the crap out of there again and get in there where I can find humility. I've had it. I had a powerful spiritual program twice and lost it twice. Both times because I compromised it. Both times because of a relationship. Somebody else did not believe what I believed. And rather than sticking up for what I believed, and I didn't say anything, and I didn't leave. And when I compromised it, I lost it. Man, that's a hard lesson. Don't ever compromise something. Even if you're wrong, you can change it if you're wrong, but if you lose it, it is tough to get spirituality back, especially the second time. First time, it wasn't so hard to get it back. You know, okay, you made a mistake. But the second time, I had this feeling that maybe God was giving up on me again. Because I remember when I first went to AA that people would talk about what they had done and didn't think they deserved God's forgiveness. And I'd say, oh, yes, you do. And in my head, I'd say that. Oh, yeah, listen to yourself. How sad you are. How repentant you are. God will forgive you, but not me. I actually believe I'd gone too far. Of course, I had a Catholic priest that told me that. I went to see him and he said, do you think I've gone too far? And he said, yes, you are a lost soul. That's true. And so I said, well, thank you very much. And Father Joe, fuck you. I did. I'm sorry. Amy, I'm sorry. It took me years to find out how wrong he was writing a Bible. 1987, I got tired of what people were telling me. And somebody 2 years before that had given me a parallel Bible, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 different Bibles all on the same page, about that thick. I started reading that thing in 87. I haven't stopped. Boy, is there a lot of things in there that people say that are not true. Or they use half-truth, or they take a first part of a sentence out of the Old Testament and hook it up with a sentence in the New Testament and sound like it was all together in the Bible. It isn't even close to each other. It comes out of context. It doesn't even mean the same thing. So I wanted to know how to pray. And in my exciting journey of finding out how to do that, I found that part that said, beware of those many people in their fine regalia. They've already got their just reward. They're seen, you know, they got all these things on and hats and paraphernalia they're wearing. And then he said, beware of those people who repeat their many prayers over and over and over again. They have got their just reward. People see how pious they are. But it says, if you want to talk to me, go into a quiet place and talk like this. Minus the swear words. Talk. And I said, that means no these, thous, theirs, and them fors. I can just go in and be Bud. That's what I took from that. My first sincere prayer to God was in a quiet place until I got there. It was in a woods. I wouldn't want anybody to hear me. And I prayed to God at the top of my lungs. I was mad. And I told him I was mad, and I told him all the things he had done to me and not to me because of this disease that he gave me. That was my first prayer. He didn't strike me dead. I'm embarrassed about that now, but that's where I was. I was angry. I was full of rage. I was full of resentments. And I had no spirituality. But I guess he understood that because he started opening up doors for me. I got to tell you something. I wasn't going to do this, but I got to tell you something. The first time that I met Sandy, we were playing golf at Deer Island, George, me, and another guy. And George and Sandy were in one cart, and I, me, and the other guy were in the other cart. And George sometimes gets a little discouraged with his golf game, and when he does, he gets distracted, you know, doesn't pay attention to what he's doing. And he lost control of the cart on this one little hill, and it started going down towards the pond. And he slammed on the brakes to stop it, and it just got the white front wheels in the pond. But in the meantime, Sandy came flying out, you know, head first right on the ground, slid right up to the edge of the pond, and laying right in the pond, there was a gator. Opened up his damn mouth, took one look at Sandy, and made a roar, and flipped his tail and took off. Sandy was as white as a ghost. We pulled up and we said, what happened? What happened? And George said, do you guys see what I just did? Sandy says, hey, wait until you see what I just did. Yeah. Sorry, Sandy. I grew up in an alcoholic family. My father was an abusive alcoholic. I got drunk for the first time at age 7. I was in an Irish family. My grandmother was a superstitious gal. Nice lady, but superstitious. She had all these home remedies, you know, and I got a chest cold. And so they made up a mustard plaster, and they took flannel and cooked onions and wrapped it up in the flannel and put it on your chest and gave you a hot toddy, whiskey and honey. So I drank the hot toddy, ate the onions, and sang half the night, you know. I was drunk. I never forgot that experience. I couldn't wait till I could drink again. I did sneak beers out of my dad's beer every now and then, but not much. 13 years old, I went to work for my dad, who was a painting contractor, and started earning my own money. And my dad had a guy that worked for him named Russ that would buy me anything I wanted in any quantity that I wanted. And he was there all the way up until I was 21. I wasn't a very popular kid until I turned out to be the kid that could get anything. Then I had all kinds of friends, got invited to all the parties. Sometimes it'd take Russ and I 4 or 5 hours to go pick up all the stuff because he wouldn't go into one place and buy 12 cases of beer. I was in deep trouble with alcohol by the time I was 21. I had been in a lot of no legal trouble. There's just a lot of embarrassing situations, passing out, blacking out, doing things that when they told me what I did that were just breaking, heartbreaking. Age 21, I'm already married, got 2 kids, and I got a DUI. The guilt almost killed me. My neighbor was in AA. He took me to a meeting in a town about 30 miles away. We didn't have any meetings in our town. And it literally was in the basement of a church, an unfinished basement. They had a table down there with a bulb, you know, hanging down, that old typical glass bulb, no shade or anything. And that was AA. The women were in there, too, because they didn't have an Al-Anon meeting. And this guy's, they're telling me these horror stories. I'm 21. These guys are 50 and 60 and 5 years old. You know, they've been down the road, scared the heck out of me. I didn't have any experiences like that. This one guy said, yeah, one time I got on a binge. He says, I got on a bus and woke up in Chicago. And he says, I'm damn lucky my wife let me come back home. He says, you're damn right you are, you and SOB. And, I mean, they got in a fight. That was AA. I went anyway because I didn't want to drink, but I got driven out. I didn't have the guts to stay by my own family. My father was an alcoholic. My mother didn't want to admit it, and so they were ashamed of me being AA. My wife was a daughter of a doctor who was an alcoholic and a pill addict, and he didn't give a damn, but her mother didn't want her daughter's husband to be an AA. My wife didn't want me to be an AA, and at first she just shunned me, and then she cut me off, and then she kicked me out of the bedroom because I was bringing shame on the family. So after 6 months, I had enough. I dropped out of AA. Went 3 more months without drinking. I went to a charity dance and drank 9 Canadian clubs and water and didn't even get drunk. I said, gee, I'm not an alcoholic after all, am I? I didn't know the phenomenon had taken place. Biochemically, I changed on the inside and I had tolerance. I mean, I had tolerance. I could drink a lot. I drank on and off and getting in periodic trouble, no more DUIs. Lucky, I would have about 6,000. I'm trying to find my way through life, and it's going to be hard because I was ADD kid. They didn't even know what ADD was, and a series of experiences kind of left me feeling stupid. The first one was when I was 7, I got ran over by a car. And got beat up pretty bad and was put in the hospital and then home and then back to school, and they put me right where I was without catching me up. A year later, I blew a furnace up in my face and was blind for 6 months. Took me out, same thing, put me back in, didn't catch me up, and I was behind from the rest of the time out. I graduated 130th out of 130 kids. That means six kids were dumber than me. That doesn't give you a lot of enthusiasm about your future. But I had a wife and two kids, and by that, I had a third one. And at age 28 and a half, I went to work for a corporation, and it was a magic fit. I don't know what it was about corporations. I got with one was at about $25 million, and when I left it, it was at $300 million. And I got in there just at the right time, and I worked my way up in a flash, and I went on a seven-year controlled drinking experience. My career was more important to me than anything, and so I lived two lives. If I got drunk, it was at home, which was a long ways away, and nobody in that town worked at the same place that I did, and when I came to work, heck, I never drank. Flew around on private corporate jets all over the place, and I never drank. And that worked really well until they sent me to Australia to open up the first international expansion. Anybody ever been to Australia? Oh, my gosh, do they drink down there, and the greatest beer you ever tasted in your life, and I was drunk. All the time, not all the time I did my work, but I drank weekends and nights. And when I came back, I had crossed the line and could not stop. I knew the axe was going to come, and before anybody even got close to finding out how serious my problem was, I left. I shocked everybody. Where's our golden boy going? I had to get out of there. I couldn't stand the possibility of the shame. After I left, my wife divorced me. And that did it. That killed me. I mean, everything that I was working and living for was gone. I found out many years later, it wasn't just the wife. It turned out I didn't really miss her. It was the kids and the cat and the dog and the house I'd worked so hard for and the lawn we'd put in. All of the things that make a family. And I was one of those kind of guys, you got married, you're going to be married forever, and now I'm not. Now what do I do? I took a job in Montreal, Canada, in a company that was losing money, and I turned that one around in about a year. I was away from everybody that knew me. The odds were 13 girls to one guy, which was good for my ego because I didn't have to pick anybody up because I couldn't anyhow. And I just kept going deeper off the edge. I got on job-changing binge. They'd ask me to leave, or I'd leave before they asked me, and finally I ended up unemployed and unemployable. I was drinking around the clock. I was sick, and that's when I came to Florida because I had two guys that were directors of treatment programs said, Bud, you'll never get sober in Michigan. You got too many bad memories here, and you can't let them go. So I came to Traverse, Florida, and that's where I began my 25 years of sobriety with a bunch of strangers. Worked out pretty good. I was a lucky one. I learned a few things I wanted to share for you. Number one, you probably have heard all this stuff. It's all AA stuff. Any day that you start without a plan not to drink, you got one to drink whether you know it or not. You may not drink that day, but you're going to do it. It's just a matter of time. So that's when I learned how to get up and ask God to remove my desire for alcohol and drugs. As a matter of fact, I didn't ask God. I was at a meeting. He said he didn't know of anybody that ever asked God, sincerely asked God to remove the desire for alcohol and drugs that ever drank on that day. So I did. I got up and asked him to remove my desire for alcohol on that day. When I didn't say God, I said, please. No, God, just please remove my desire. And that night I would say, thank you. I still was not connected to God in any spiritual way. I just was curious about him at that time. So that was a big change for me. I learned how to pray. I told you that. Ooh, yeah, I was mad, wasn't I? Then there was another part in the Bible I found that I read in there, and somehow I looked at it and I'd say, is that saying what I think it's saying? It's saying, who do you think you are not to accept God's forgiveness? And then it implied without saying it, but implied it. Either you got a God or you are one. And that scared me to death that I was going to be my own God. And so that was the beginning. I changed. I could repent to God, and he would completely forgive me. And then I kept reading, and I found something else that was even more exciting. It says, when you sincerely repent to God and accept his forgiveness, he will remember your sins no more, which means the second judgment's coming. It ain't coming up. Do you ever think about that? If you deal with it on earth, you ain't got to deal with it at the judgment time of Christ. And that's going to be pretty good. Boy, I've been working hard to remember everything I did. I did that. The other thing that I learned in AA, if I got a problem and I can't solve it, then I'm the problem. Then anybody else, you know, this is going wrong, why can't this come? And then I have no longer have been able to step outside the problem and take a look and see that it's me. And that's the spiritual disconnect. When I can't see that I'm the cause of the problem. That was a good insight for me. Another good insight for me was, it says, God grows orange trees. He does not make orange juice. That's another one. What the hell does that mean? To me, that means that God's going to do his part, but I got to do mine too. He's not going to make the orange juice for me. I need to get up and go do something. Like, come here. Come to a place where I can learn something new that's different. AA has been one thrilling experience for me. Early in my recovery, about 2 weeks, I went to work for a detox center as a psychiatric technician, which means you're a gopher. Nice name. $3.75 an hour. Minimum wage. I was glad to get it. I was employable. Nobody would hire me. They hired me. About 6 months after I was there, the director of the alcohol and drug program says, Bud, you ought to stay around. We're going to open up a 28-day treatment program. I said, when? He said, 2 years. I said, I ain't waiting that long. Why don't you open up a 10-day treatment program, a daytime 10-day treatment program? I said, never heard of that before. Can you put it together? I said, sure. I had corporate experience, no AA experience, so I put it together. I turned it in to him on a Friday. The board met on Monday, approved it. Came back to him on Wednesday. He resigned. They came to me on Friday and said, you put this together? And I said, yes. And they said, would you set it up? Boy, did that feed on my ego. So I ran a program, an outpatient 10-day, fairly successful, still going up there in Eustis called Crossroads 2. And that's where I got the beginning of my experience, but not enough to do anybody any good or harm. And I heard about a place called the Karen Foundation up in Pennsylvania that did internships, and so I applied. And they said, you have to come up for an interview. And the plane ticket was over $300, just $302, and I didn't have it. And they said the internship is $10,000, but on rare occasions we scholarship or partially scholarship people. And I said, no sense of me coming. I ain't got 10 grand. And they said, well, come anyway. So I got an income tax check back for $306. There was my plane ticket. I took it. And to my surprise, they accepted me and gave me an internship. Free. Scholarship, the whole thing. I was there 3 months in the internship. And they came to me and said, Bud, we're going to have you take over a group as a primary therapist. And they hadn't done that with an intern in 25 years. And there were master's degree people around. I said, what the hell do you want me to do that for? And he says, you can do this. Don't worry about it. Scared to death, but, you know, thrilled to death, but the ego. 6 months later, they made me the executive director of a 38-bed treatment program in Winchester, Virginia. I got about 4 years of recovery. I got about as much business being there. It was ridiculous. But I was good at it, and we filled it up. My marketing experience came back. But, you know, I never liked being in the treatment field because no matter what they tell you, money always comes first. God, that pissed me off. I couldn't live with that. But I sold out because they kept promoting me and got me up to about $75,000 a year. Then managed care hit. The first thing they thought about is getting rid of all the guys with the big incomes, and so they let me go. And that was it turned out to be another miracle. And I said, I'm going to Florida and play golf. I got down to Florida the third day here. Got a call from New York City, wanted to hire me as a consultant. So, you know, like 3 days later, I was in New York City, and I was there for the next 3.5 years. And I'm going to tell you that's only because of what happened next. My income was about $130,000 a year plus bonuses. And in August of that year, I sat down and did a spiritual evaluation, and I applied the 100% rule. You ever heard of that? If you want to know the truth about something, give it everything you got for a set period of time, expecting nothing in return, and everything that you want to know about the truth of that situation will be revealed to you. If you give 100%, they can't hide anything. So I gave 100% to my relationship with a girl in Washington, D.C. I gave 100% of the job in New York City, and 30 days later, I resigned. I broke up with a girl, unloaded my house in Pennsylvania, and moved back to Florida, and bought a Dumpio treatment program, outpatient treatment program, in Tavares, and then started putting together a program which I believed the principles of AA would not find in conflict with what they believe. We talk about things about AA. I don't do AA in treatment. I don't believe that you should charge people for things you can get for free. And I don't think working the first 3 or 4 steps in a treatment program is the same as working with a sponsor. I just don't. So I've been doing that since 1997. I'm still doing that now. It's rewarding work. I like the work I'm doing. We've been blessed. God has blessed us. With the staff that I have and the people that I work with. And now that I come down here, I just feel blessed all over again. The part of me that I felt when was disconnected has opened up again. And I can feel it just reaching out there like little fingers trying to connect with me everywhere. One of the most exciting things I read recently was that the feeling neurotransmitters that you have in your brain, also in your heart, and in your gut. So when you say you got gut feeling, and you have feelings in your heart and in your brain, you do. That was great, because I have these things going on all the time. And so my gut feeling said, Bud, you need to get down here and be with other people like yourself who are on the same spiritual path. And geez, that turned out to be exactly what I've been missing. Thank you very much.